Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll hear from Appalachians who have a knack for building things with their hands. Our region is still home to a few who make the essentials of life in the old ways.
And when I sit down at one of those looms and I start creating a piece of cloth, I feel connected to the place of my ancestors. I feel connected to the people that have come before.
We'll also hear from a new generation of Appalachian makers dedicated to keeping these traditions going, like a young chef practicing the art of salt rising bread.
Growing up, I didn't realize how special it was, and I just thought it was something that people had everywhere. It was just a type of bread, but it wasn't until I moved back home in my 30s that I realized that it was really only in this region, and you really couldn't get it anymore.
From yeastless bread making to valuing what's in our own backyards, today we'll be hearing stories about makers and doers, creators and innovators, and keepers of old knowledge. That's all coming up on this week's episode of Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. You know, when I think about all the things my Appalachian ancestors did to survive in West Virginia, I realize just how creative, innovative, and adaptive they were. They made all the things we ship in from factories overseas today. Rugs, blankets, brooms. I wonder how many of us now could make everything we need to survive. That kind of hands-on knowledge can easily be forgotten if we don't notice it and share it. Larry Mustaine, who owns the last operating grist mill in West Virginia, knows this all too well.
And there's just so much that we've lost, and I have questions, and there's no one over 90 that's here to answer them for me.
Larry and I recently sat down for a chat before a live audience in Beckley. His family has operated the same mill for generations, so he sees how these maker traditions pass away or survive over time. Larry's uncle knew how to grow food and grind his own cornmeal and countless other practical things, but he'd never gone to college.
When I got my first degree, he said, "Well, that's great, and I'm glad to see you getting an education, but I just hope you don't become one of these people that's educated beyond your intelligence." And then when
Sounds like a smart man.
When I got my master's degree, he said, "Well, now I know you're educated beyond your intelligence."
I think I would have liked Larry's uncle. That was one of my favorite parts of the evening. College does provide opportunities, but I think what Larry's uncle was getting at is that formal education doesn't always include the more practical skills in life, like how to grow and prepare something as basic as cornmeal. Today on Inside Appalachia, we'll hear stories of people who are finding ways to pass on the practical arts of our collective past to a new generation. Hand weavers once made many of our fabrics and rugs on old wooden looms, thread by thread.
Your blue jeans are a plain weave. If I want a patterned weave, I'm going to raise the threads in different combinations.
As the textile industry industrialized, these artisans began to disappear.
The things called lambs, which determine which of these harnesses go up. Depending on which ones I step on which ones come up.
But there are some people, like Jane Gilchrist, who still remember this craft and even manage to make a living practicing it, one thread at a time. Our Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan visited Gilchrist at her studio in Harrison County, West Virginia, and brings us this story.
Just off a narrow neighborhood road in Stonewood, West Virginia, is a small brick store with a sign called Loomy Lady Hand Wovens. Inside, Jane Gilchrist shows me her weaving workshop.
This is pot holders. I've got mug rugs on these three looms. This loom is a Hammett loom. It's called a school loom. This is called a tri-loom. So basically, it's a triangle.
Jane's been pursuing the art of weaving for almost 2 decades, but it only recently became her main source of income. When she weaves, she sits on a sheepskin-covered bench facing the loom. She wears a green top patterned with teal petunia petals. Her nails are painted a rouge pink. Tall shelves that almost touch the ceiling are filled with colorful yarns. A hand-woven baby blue coverlet blanket with little white flowers is on display. In the corner are some of Jane's pot holders and scarves for sale.
So this is the overshot pot holder. I'm doing this in a real pretty earthy green with a natural warp.
This small shop is also Jane's space for creating. In the center of the room, there are three wooden looms and one table loom hanging on the wall. They're all no bigger than a desk, and each loom holds a different project. Several looms even sit folded up in the corner.
And when I pass it over, as I step on the treadle, based upon the way I've threaded this loom, on which of the shafts or harnesses raise up.
Now, that might have sounded like a foreign language. Essentially, she's describing how she's threading the colored yarn through a base of tightly strung yarn to create a pattern. So when she steps on a treadle, a layer of the tightly strung yarn lifts up, allowing her to thread the colored yarn through, which with enough threading creates a tightly woven item, like a potholder. Jane grew up in Ohio with eight other siblings and not a lot of money.
I was the next to the youngest, and I just always kind of felt like I was lost. I was the little fat kid without a lot of friends and middle of nowhere living on a farm, and I was pretty lonely.
But she made friends with a woman who was quadriplegic, although she had some use of her arms. This woman introduced Jane to weaving.
So she had a big rug loom, and she made rugs, and I sat next to her, and I got introduced to weaving. I always knew someday I wanted to be a weaver. That just felt right to me.
It feels right because it's her happy place. Jane says it's a repetitive motion that's relaxing while still requiring focus.
I don't have time to sit and think about what is or isn't, or the good or the bad, and dwell on things I can't change or I can't control.
She later learned that weaving was also part of her family's history. She has record that her great-great-grandfather used weaving as a source of income during the long, cold West Virginian winters. Jane says weaving was essential in the early settler days in Appalachia, as it helped create cloth for clothing and blankets, items that weren't yet available in the rural region. But as clothing became more available during the Industrial Revolution, weaving became a lost art.
It went from being an essential that you have to do this to being a hobby.
So Jane does her part to help keep an Appalachian tradition alive.
And when I sit down at one of those looms and I start creating a piece of cloth, I feel connected to the place of my ancestors. I feel connected to the people that have come before.
Over the years, Jane has become a reputable weaver. She's part of the Tamarack Foundation, an organization for professional artists that's not easy to get into. She's able to sell some of her products, like the potholders, through Tamarack. She also has her master's in education, so she's developed several weaving tutorials for classroom settings. In fact, about 60% of her income is from teaching weaving. But her biggest claim to fame is something she calls
Mug Ruggin' It.
That's Mug Ruggin' It, as in a rug for your coffee mug. Get it? Jane teaches Mug Ruggin' as an informal class at several West Virginian art festivals and fairs, where people can weave a rug for their mugs. It's a spin-off of a traditional Appalachian rag rug, just downsized. Over the past 5 years, Jane estimates 3,000 people have been through the Mug Ruggin' It program.
I hope someday when I'm old and decrepit and I'm walking down through a craft show or a flea market, or I'm out somewhere and I see somebody who's got their wares for sale, and I say to them, "Where'd you learn to weave? What'd you do this?" And they say, "Oh, well, back in, I went to the Vandalia Festival, and there were these people that came by, and they set up these looms, and I did this thing called Mug Ruggin' It, and I fell in love with weaving."
Jane tries to keep her weaving as traditional as possible. She's even learned to dye her own yarn as well as spin her own wool, which she's dedicated a decent amount of her living space to. With a full-on yarn dyeing station set up near the laundry room and a wool spinner near the TV. The art of weaving is her life. Some people might caution turning a hobby into a livelihood, but it's not work for her. Jane says she knows she's never going to get rich off it either, but that's okay.
But if I can make the world more creative and they understand our heritage as we get further and further away from those existence days, if they have a better understanding of it because I can share that with them, I'll think I've done something pretty special.
Jane says weaving as a profession in Appalachia has its challenges, as it's such a large region with many rural stretches. Other weavers, as well as some of her own customers, are at least an hour drive away. But she says she wouldn't have it any other way, as she's Appalachian through and through and couldn't imagine weaving anywhere else. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Harrison County, West Virginia.
If you wanted to learn a traditional art like weaving or baking, where would you turn? Grandparents? Formal workshops? An old neighbor? A few years ago, the West Virginia Humanities Council launched a project to help encourage traditional artists to teach their crafts to a new generation. The master artists each receive a $3,000 stipend to spend a year teaching an apprentice. Kara Vanek and Marion Harless focused their study on the craft of making teas, jellies, and other value-added products out of herbs and other ingredients you can find right in the woods. On a rainy morning last fall, Roxy Todd went to speak with them at Marion's home in Randolph County, West Virginia.
In Marion's dining room, surrounded by houseplants, I sit beside Kara Vanek, who grins as she talks about all that Marion has taught her.
Every time I enter the garden, I learn something new. Her garden is arranged by color. I'm also learning a lot of recipes from her. We made dandelion frittata. We harvested fresh dandelions and just sauteed them in oil and a little bit of butter, of course, and added eggs and just fried it up, and it was delicious.
And Marion, what has it been like to be passing all this on to a young person? Is this anything like how you learned to do some of these things?
I learned about plants from the time I can remember, which is very, 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 very early. So I can remember lying on my baby blanket, my yellow plaid baby blanket under the spice bush at our house. And I just learned plants. At last fall, somebody asked me that, and I said, well, they said, how do you know the difference between blah, blah, blah? I said, well, how do you know the difference between carrots and cabbages and lettuces, et cetera? You just learn it as you're growing up. And by the time I was five, I knew 21 kinds of trees and shrubs we had in the yard, and and many, many flowers and all the vegetables, et cetera. And just keep learning. And every time I meet somebody or read something, I usually learn something new. If you don't learn something every day, that's a wasted day as far as I'm concerned.
Do you ever worry that some of this knowledge will fade away with the next generation?
No, it has already faded. I mean, when I tell people the hemlock hedge, there are hemlocks in front of my house, people don't know hemlocks. John Fitchner, who's a VOAG teacher, sustainable forestry, down at Clayrone, he said, ask 10 people what kind of tree acorns grow on. Maybe one will know. And so the
knowledge. It's oak, right?
What?
It's oak trees, right?
Yes, it's oak trees. Yeah, yeah. Good. There's very little knowledge. And we can teach kids engineering principles with spaghetti and marshmallows, but they have no idea where spaghetti comes from or where marshmallows come from, or that there's actually a plant called marshmallow, etc. If you just take a child out and say, let's sit down here on the grass and look at things, there's nothing there, but you can find all sorts of things, including ants and sow bugs and whatnot, and other little plants too. Yes, we need to be getting kids outdoors. If we could just get those kids out here and plunk them down in the grass, that would be a good start. So.
Yeah, I have a young girl, a neighbor friend, who spends time with me in the garden. And the other day we were in the garden and she saw a praying mantis and said, just like on TV. And so it was really exciting to kind of share that experience with her of experiencing something real. So, yeah, I think kids definitely need to get outside a little bit more. And it's been great to be inspired by Marion to share nature with some younger kids in the neighborhood.
So do you, as a young person, 34 years old, do you feel that this kind of knowledge, these traditions have a place in the future?
Oh, definitely. And I think a lot of them get obscured or kind of lost or maybe confused. Understanding plants is kind of the first key to feeding ourselves, and that seems like if we can meet one of our basic needs in the future, it's pretty important to understand how to do that, and understanding plants is the first step to that.
That was Kara Vanek and her teacher herbalist Marion Harless. Kara uses the training she received with Marion to make handmade products through her business called Smoke Camp Crafts. If you thought that dandelion frittata sounded yummy, get ready to meet another traditional Appalachian food, salt rising bread. Most people outside the region have never heard of it. That's because the recipe grew out of the distinctive quality of life on the Appalachian frontier. But for those in the know, it often brings to mind a variety of distinctive scents and scenes of grandmothers tending to a time-intensive dough in a wood-heated kitchen. Our Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan went to the farm of another Folklife apprentice, Amy Dawson, to see and taste how her study of salt rising bread has been going.
Yeast is a leavening agent that makes bread rise, giving it that familiar rounded top. It's what makes it look like bread. But salt rising bread doesn't use yeast. Recipes date back to the late 1700s, where pioneer women in the remote mountains of Appalachia figured out another way to make bread. Something no one else discovered. Amy Dawson, who recently became somewhat of a salt rising bread expert, explains from her kitchen in Harrison County.
It was common in this area because we were so isolated. There were no easy ways to get to town. There weren't breweries just everywhere where you could get yeast to leaven your bread. And so it was just through kind of trial and error and just a need to get your bread leavened.
The bread can rise only through the cultivation of bacteria. Safe bacteria that's found everywhere. It takes milk or potatoes, heat, and, well, time. A lot of time. It takes about 12 hours to make. And Amy is very familiar. She spent the past year training under experts Genevieve Bardwell and Susan Ray Brown. They started Rising Creek Bakery in Pennsylvania, which is one of the last places people can buy salt rising bread today. Amy's also the baker and co-owner of Lost Creek Farm, a traveling farm-to-table kitchen that serves up traditional Appalachian cuisine. And although she grew up in Lost Creek, West Virginia, surrounded by salt rising bread, she'd never made it before this apprenticeship.
Growing up, I didn't realize how special it was, and I just thought it was something that people had everywhere. It was just a type of bread, but it wasn't until I moved back home in my 30s that I realized that it was really only in this region, and you really couldn't get it anymore.
Amy is preparing to bake bread in her old farmhouse kitchen, which is perhaps the very same kitchen her ancestors baked in.
My great-grandma, Rachel Blake Dawson, who grew up in this house, made salt rising bread. And I just think she probably learned it from her mom, so I bet a lot of salt rising bread was made in this very house.
The simplest salt rising bread recipe is just flour and water. But the more ingredients, the more chance for bacteria to grow, so Amy likes to hedge her bets. For her starter, she mixes sliced potato, cornmeal, flour, baking soda, and hot water all in a quart-sized mason jar. She covers it with plastic wrap and a jar ring. The bacteria needs to breathe, so she pokes a hole in the wrap.
All the recipes say the same thing. You put it in a warm place. And then they don't say anything more about it. But for the particular bacteria that creates the rise in salt rising bread, the fermentation, you need it between 104 and 110 degrees Fahrenheit.
Traditionally, bakers kept their starters on or around their wood stoves.
In pioneer days, the women just knew their fires and they knew where to put it overnight and that it would be the right temperature. And it's amazing that they figured it out because that's a very narrow temperature range.
But today, rather than a wood stove, Amy uses a sous vide for temperature accuracy. The sous vide is a curling iron-shaped tool that keeps a pot of water at a set temperature. She sets her starters in the heated pot overnight and checks them after 8 to 12 hours.
You want a foam layer on the top of your starter.
So kind of what we're looking at is a white starter, the ingredients of it at the bottom, and then there's like almost a liquid layer where you can mm-hmm. kind of see through, and then the foam on top.
Yeah, that shows you that bacteria is working. Those are the air bubbles from the bacteria.
At this stage, Amy takes out the potato slices and adds about half a cup of flour to the starter. But there are no precise measurements. It should resemble somewhat of a thin pancake batter.
And so I just add not even a lot of hot water, just a little splash. I don't know if it makes a difference. It's funny, you get into your own kind of routine and you think, oh, that's the ticket.
The starter has to sit once more in the heat. It takes about 30 minutes for it to be in what's called the sponge stage. It'll still be a thin mixture, but it will have risen to the top of the jar. Amy says a starter can usually make up to 10 loaves, but today she's making 3. She mixes the sponge in a bowl with hot water and adds about a teaspoon of salt for each loaf, and then about a cup of flour per loaf.
Yeah, the good thing about this is it's not really measured.
With the flour? Or just any of
it? Well, really with any of it. Yeah, you just need to make a dough at this point.
It has an interesting smell, one that has a polarizing reputation. It smells kind of like a strong, aging cheese. And Amy had an appetizing way of phrasing it.
I don't want to say decomposing, but you know, you can tell things are breaking down in there and stuff's getting moving.
Amy says she's never heard of the bacteria hurting anyone. However, if your starter doesn't rise within 12 hours, it's best to just throw it out. Once the starter is mixed into a dough, Amy kneads it for several minutes.
Like any bread, for it to catch the gases from the bacteria, you need to work up the gluten so that it'll hold.
She divides the dough into 3 equal logs and puts them in greased rectangle loaf pans. And then, well, more waiting. The dough has to sit again at about 104 degrees for an hour or until it rises. A low setting on an oven or on top of a wood stove is a great place. The name salt rising bread is still a bit of a mystery. Amy says her mentors Genevieve and Susan have one theory they explain in their book about the bread. During an interview with another expert on the bread, Susan and Jenny ask about saltratus, a precursor to baking soda.
They asked her about this saltratus, and she said, saltratus, oh yes, I remember hearing about that. And they said just the way she said it, they thought saltratus, salt rising.
That's just one of the several theories on the name. Amy checks on the dough, and it's ready. After rising, it should double in size. She heats the oven to 400 degrees and sticks the loaves in for 30 minutes, and she turns them halfway through. When all is said and done, the whole process is easily 12 to 15 hours. One begins to think, why not just buy bread from the store or just make a quicker bread with yeast? Amy has a good explanation.
Because it would just be lost. Well, salt rising bread specifically is such a unique thing. And all of these recipes and food heritage, and I think it's very important to keep it because it's what makes us West Virginian and it's what makes us unique.
The loaves come out of the oven and the whole kitchen is filled with a warm, grainy smell. The loaves are a beautiful golden color. It's best to let them cool before cutting into them. So Amy cuts into a loaf she made the night before. She butters the slices and puts them on the stovetop. She recalls an early memory of her grandmother burning salt rising bread.
She kept her butter in the refrigerator. And so I just remember her scraping cold butter over burnt salt. And it smelled so good. It looked so good. I don't know what it was, but sometimes now if I accidentally burn some toast, I think she's still around, but I think of her.
And finally, we get to taste the bread. It has a lovely crunchy crust, and each bite makes itself known. It's uniquely delicious.
It's got like a stick to your teeth, like chewiness to it.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah,
and surprisingly has like a nice savory kind of, like you said, a little cheesy, salty flavor.
Mm-hmm.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Lost Creek, West Virginia.
You can find pictures and recipes for salt rising bread at our website, wvpublic.org. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I go visit an artist with an unlikely day job.
Comic relief at a sewer plant is essential to this job.
Yeah?
It gets a little crappy down here sometimes, man.
That's up ahead on Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today's episode is a look at material culture in Appalachia. We're meeting people who are making things with their hands out of what's locally available. I recently traveled to the studio of one such artist in Athens, West Virginia, that houses the unique flair, personality, and dreams of the metal sculptor Mike Sizemore. Mike has a particular fondness for copper, but he uses all sorts of materials in his work, even recycled glass ashtrays. You can find his sculptures at Concord University, private yards, city streets and other public places, and at Tamarack in Beckley, West Virginia, which features juried artists from across the state. For Mike's work, imagine pipes bent into abstractions of owls, turtles, and even the New River Gorge Bridge. Some of his work, which can tower as tall as 30 feet, is often inspired by petroglyphs from ancient drawings. His art earns him money, but as we'll find out, he still keeps a day job. Mike traces his love of art making back to one day when he was growing up in Fayette County, and his mother insisted that he and his brother go to school despite a blizzard.
And everybody else was home sleigh riding, but my butt was in school, and my older brother was in the same school at the time. And so to give me something to do, she brought me in one of the footstools and gave me a box of chalk, and she told me to draw the solar system on the chalkboards. So I drew the solar system. It took me all day. But what I really remember is coming into class the next day, and everybody was amazed how cool it was. It was like little tours that came into the classroom that said, wow, this is really cool. And I remember, you know, to the amazement of Mrs. Tully, the principal, she was like, wow, this is really good. And they brought in other chalkboards so they didn't have to erase it. Yeah, that felt pretty good.
That was the first time Mike realized he had something special to share. As a middle schooler, a mischievous Mike took his drawings from chalkboards to, well, other surfaces.
I remember seeing airbrush t-shirts. And I'm thinking, I've been graffiti painting all over Fayette County. Why not take it down to small scale and put it on a shirt? So, yeah, let me say I did a fair amount of graffiti painting all around Oak Hill. Sorry, Mom and Dad.
Mike also was helped along the way by some of his family in Roanoke, Virginia, especially his infamous Aunt Leona.
And she moved to Roanoke to work for the railroad. And she was a horse snuff dipping, cigar smoking, drinking hard woman. But she was cool.
Mike's cousin Tom had a blacksmith shop in Aunt Leona's garage. That's where Mike heated up his first piece of metal. Mike went on to study art at Concord, then college. Then he moved to New Mexico, where he learned from other metal sculptors and discovered petroglyphs, a rock carving left by Pueblo Indians.
And I would get on my mountain bike and go out to these things and spend hours in them, taking photographs of them, so forth and so on. And I was just mesmerized. There's a language in that.
He eventually brought that inspiration back to West Virginia and blended it with his affection for our state and its lush scenery. While this 50-year-old Oak Hill native's art business has been growing over the past 10 or so years, like many artists, he keeps his day job. And his occupation might surprise you. I caught up with Mike at a town sewer plant.
Walk us through a typical day of what you do.
Sure. Well, the typical day, just showing up at 7 o'clock, and you can typically smell if something's gone wrong at a sewer plant.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's supposed to not stink if it's working correctly. So that's the first thing you do when you drive up on the bridge and unlock the gate, is something gone amok. And
how are we today?
We are in great shape today.
I think so, too.
The plant's operating correctly.
Nice.
Mike sure does keep his sense of humor on the job. I even notice a no fishing sign hung on a cement tank full of sludge.
We have one in the lab also that says ask for free samples.
Oh, nice.
You know.
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Comic relief at a sewer plant is essential to this job.
Yeah?
It gets a little crappy down here sometimes, man.
Mike's plumbing experience goes way back. Growing up in Fayette County, he heard about the days when indoor toilets were first introduced to the area.
My mother's father was a manager in the mines, so they were the first people in Whipple to have a flushing toilet. You know, everything else just went out to the creek, so it was a pretty big deal.
Mike has deep roots here. His ancestors were Italian immigrants and native Cherokee. Mike's parents also grew up in Fayette County, where bartering was a way of life.
My parents did it on a fairly decent scale, and you know, they still do it to this day. They're antique collectors, so if you need your grass cut, and this person wants the nice cabinet out back that my mom's been collecting for 20 years, and she'll get a grass cut for the summer, and he'll get the cabinet.
Mike learned to be resourceful, too. He says it was often a matter of survival. He recalls gathering glass bottles along the side of the road as a kid in Oak Hill for extra cash.
Remember when you could take bottles back and get a 3 cents for them?
Yeah,
that was our job on Saturday morning, is to go, we'd steal a buggy from the A&P or borrow it or, you know, whatever you want to call it. We always took it back. We took it back full of bottles. And then when I wanted money, I'd go get bottles myself, my friends.
He remembers those days fondly, but they weren't easy, carefree days.
It was pretty tough. And that struggle, you know, it got passed down to all of us. I think it basically taught you, if you want it, you got to go get it. Where do you want to be? What do you need to get there? Got to find a way to do it. Do it without breaking the law. My parents taught me that too, which we didn't always succeed at. Occasionally, you know.
Today, there are lots of colorful walls adorned with paintings and metal sculptures in Mike's home, relying on that time-tested tradition of bartering. Mike has collected hundreds of pieces of art by trading his own work. And it's taken some growth and courage, but he's making money selling his art, too.
I don't know too many people like myself that can actually take any metal and turn it into something. It's taken me a long time to get to that point because I just want to make people happy. And I do make people happy. But now it's business coming into that fold.
Mike's planning on retiring soon from the sewage treatment plant, so he's taken on a young apprentice. He plans to work more on his art, but these days he's getting help from his son, Willie, especially when it comes to the digital presence of his work. As he teaches Willie to weld, his son helps out with social media. So it seems the dependable barter practice of Mike's past is still helping to take him forward. Back in 2017, we aired a story about a West Virginia broommaker, Jim Schaefer, who has been practicing his craft since 1946. Since it aired, a video of Jim went viral online, and people from New York to Florida decided to come visit Jim and get one of his special handmade brooms. Today, we're going to share an exciting update about the legacy of Jim's business. But first, let's listen back to folklorist Emily Hilliard's visit to Jim's workshop in Loudoundale, West Virginia, in the fall of 2016.
I arrive at Charleston Broom and Mop on a brisk fall morning and make my way through the storage room, past rolls of straw, walls of tools hanging on pinboards, and dozens of brooms, bundled and stacked in tall rows. I find Jim Schaefer inside his dusty workshop, standing at a machine that helps him attach straw to a broomstick.
Well, I'm James Schaefer. Most people call me Jim. I'm 87 years old, and I'm the owner of Charleston Broom and Mop Company here in Loudoundale, only 1 mile short of Kanawha State Forest.
Jim is tall, sporting jeans and suspenders, with a friendly face and big smile. His hands move adeptly around the broomstick, adding straw by the handful. He's done this so long, he doesn't need to measure. He can build a broom by feel. Jim's brooms are the classic straw variety, the image you get in your mind when you think of a broom. They have a wooden handle, natural straw with wire binding the two at the top, and 5 bands of colored thread sewn across the midline of the broom. Often this thread is red, but he also sews them with blue, green, yellow, or white thread. The broom style and the equipment he uses hasn't really changed since Jim first started making them when he was 17.
Well, the change has been in the usage of brooms. Instead of sweeping sidewalks and outside garage areas and everything, they use the gasoline blowers now to blow the dirt and dust away. Same thing in the house with these new laminate floors they have. They're so slick that they've developed dust mops type things for those sweeping of the house and things, those that have those floors, and there's, you know, an awful lot of them. So the broom industry is fading out. I suspect another 5 to 7 years you won't find a straw broom in the store.
Today, Jim's main customers are local Lions clubs who buy them and sell them for their annual fundraisers.
If it wasn't for Lions clubs selling brooms as their fundraisers, I wouldn't have a business today. But Walmart, Kmart, and Kroger's have took all that over now, and you don't have any mom-and-pop stores to buy from the wholesale distributors, so they all went out of business.
Jim also sells at Pyle Hardware, a local store that's been operating on Charleston's west side for 84 years, just 3 years younger than Jim himself. Bill Pyle owns a store and says customers even make special trips to Charleston just to buy Jim's brooms.
I mean, he does that out of pride. I mean, when he turns out a broom, he wants it to be just right, and he's proud of it, you know. And skilled craftsmen are just few and far between.
Bill is a third-generation owner of Pyle Hardware. Back when he was a teenager working for his dad, Bill's father sent him to buy brooms from Jim. Bill leads me through the hardware store, past rows of pocket knives, bird feeders, and Dutch ovens, to the broom rack.
There's a 6, there's an 8, and the 8's a little bit bigger. They make a Black Beauty that has black bristles in it. Then they make warehouse and railroad brooms, and they're usually a broom that's made to heavy, sweep heavy stuff.
If Jim Schaefer is shopping at a store other than Pyle, he makes sure to check out the broom competition. He judges a store based on the brooms they sell.
Oh, the synthetic plastic straw doesn't compare to a natural corn broom at all, the sweeping quality of it.
Along with the natural straw, another feature that makes Jim's brooms unique are the 5 bands of thread he sews across the broom to hold the straw together. This detail factors heavily in Jim's pride in his product, as well as his judgment of other brooms.
We see a lot of them in the store today with 3 bands or so, and I don't approve of that. I don't think I've ever made an order for anyone with 3 bands. I have used 5 and 6. That sewing of the broom makes the durability longer if it's sewn tight enough that it doesn't, in time, flex and come, you know, loose to where it flips instead of sweeps.
So you look down on a 3-band broom?
Well, sure. Whatever product you're into, anybody else don't come up to your standards, you don't approve of it.
As Jim showed off his different broom models, whisk brooms, toy brooms for kids, heavy-duty brooms for industrial projects, and standard household brooms, I noticed an old sign hanging on his wall. Framing a blue graphic of an eagle, red block letters read, NRA Code, Broom Manufacturing, 1934. Jim's quick to tell me that that's not the NRA I might be thinking of, but the National Recovery Administration, part of Roosevelt's New Deal. The NRA set minimum wages and maximum work hours for the broom industry.
Franklin D. Roosevelt, as far as I'm concerned, was the best leader and will always be the best leader that the country's ever had. He recognized all industry.
While Jim may have slowed down, that's not apparent from the tall stacks of brooms lining his workshop. When Jim's gone, though, it isn't clear how the broom-making tradition will continue in West Virginia.
When I finally give up on it, I guess it'll just die. I don't know. A lot of people in the Lions Club kind of worry about it. Some of them have even considered, you know, trying to run it on their own.
Jim has taught some apprentices over the years, but no one has stuck with it. When it comes to retirement, though, Jim isn't interested.
Well, you got to have something to do. I feel great every day. So I have to do something. Since if I wasn't here making brooms, I'd be maybe over at McDonald's making hamburgers or something. I mean, you need to keep yourself occupied and busy if you're able to. And thank goodness I've been able to pretty much all my life.
Jim says that the only downfall to his job is that he does get lonely.
Sometimes I'll go a week without somebody walking through the door. But it really doesn't bother me a whole lot, but I do enjoy company.
To pass the time while he works, Jim keeps his radio tuned to WQBE, Country and Western. And he's worn out a number of radios in his time on the job. There's at least three stacked in his workshop, covered with cobwebs and broom straw. But Jim always appreciates visitors. He'll even make a special broom for you, right on the spot. For Inside Appalachia and the West Virginia Folklife Program, I'm Emily Hilliard in Loudoundale, West Virginia.
To see the full video of Jim Schaefer's story, head to our website at wvpublic.org. That story was part of a partnership between West Virginia Public Broadcasting and the West Virginia Humanity Council's Folklife Program. We'll be hearing more about that project in the coming months here on Inside Appalachia. Since that story aired, Jim decided to close his shop after 7 decades of hard work. He was slowing down and just couldn't put in the long days anymore. But we're excited to share this update about Jim's business. Lo and behold, he found a new broom maker, Wanda Hott, who wanted to take over the reins. Liz McCormick went to hear how she and even some of her younger family members are pitching in to keep the art of sweeping alive in Appalachia.
Just about 20 miles from Romney, West Virginia, is a little town called Kirby. Kirby is home to Wanda Hott and her family. She owns this big farm on a hill. It's lush, green, and misty from rain. She and her husband raise beef cattle here, and they grow a variety of vegetables and fruits. Cucumbers and some of the best and sweetest grapes I've ever tasted. This farm has been in her family since the 1930s. Wanda works as a professional school bus driver for Hampshire County Schools during a normal work day, but for more than a decade, she's also been a broom maker.
I got into broom making because my sister wanted to know what I wanted for Christmas one year, and I needed a broom. I wanted a practical broom, and she got me a broom from Jim Schaefer. And I looked at it, and I thought, huh.
Wanda fell in love with that broom and remembered her great-great-grandmother used to make brooms. She wanted to learn how to make them, too, and started teaching herself. For some help, she reached out to Jim Schaefer.
I picked up the phone and gave him a call, and he answered about the 7th ring, probably.
Wanda began buying broom-making supplies from Jim, and they became friends.
When we went to Charleston to meet Jim to learn how to make brooms, he was very patient and did not mind showing how to make a broom and how to sew it. And he had brooms everywhere and broom corn, and that was just down my alley. That's what I wanted to learn.
Wanda has been making brooms for the past 13 years now. And then last year, Jim Schaefer called Wanda and told her he had decided he was not able to continue making brooms. Hoping to pass on his craft to the right person, he offered to sell her his broom-making equipment. And she accepted. Wanda hopes her broom-making business will be her main source of income once she retires from school bus driving. And as it turns out, two of Wanda's teenage granddaughters, Shelby and Kira, have taken a particular interest in the broom-making craft as well.
It sparks my interest.
That's Shelby.
It's something that I'm able to actually sit down and do or pay attention to, and it doesn't lose my interest.
And her little sister Kira feels the same way.
I'm a really hands-on person, so I really like to be able to like feel something and have it in my hands, and broom making is a really good way to do that. And I like spending family time because I think spending time with family is really important, so it's kind of a way to do both for me.
Slide that string through that green loop that you have.
Okay.
Shelby and Kira often sit with their grandma like this here in their family shop called Clay Lick Broom Shop. Wanda's taught them to make a variety of multi-purpose or decorative brooms by hand. Today, Wanda is showing her granddaughters how to wrap and tie the broom corn.
All right, you got her done. We're not going to do the pretty stuff.
Wanda says she's not really sure how the craft became such a big part of her family.
It just evolved. I learned to make the broom to start with, and then I would teach my sister and our friend, and when somebody came, they family members came, they would jump in, and it was a big thing. So just teach them, you know. Anybody wants to see, we teach them how to make brooms.
The brooms Wanda makes with Jim Schaefer's equipment take about 25 minutes to finish, and they sell for about $17. Wanda sells them to local Lions clubs, just like Schaefer did. But the brooms made in the Clay Lick Broom Shop are made entirely by hand, without the machine. Since they take longer to make, Wanda sells those for up to $50.
When we were making a broom by hand, and with the three of us doing it, we have no two brooms are alike. They're everything's different.
Wanda hopes broom making continues to spark interest for her family. For Shelby and Kira, they want to continue the tradition too. Kira says the craft is a beautiful one.
I think it's a really great thing that there are still people around that still want to make brooms, because it is a really like neat and wonderful thing to learn, especially if you're a person who likes to pick up different hobbies. It's a really neat hobby and it's a really neat thing to get to do.
And her older sister Shelby adds, being able to make brooms is a practical tool to have.
It's something that I think should be passed on. People should know how to do it, because you're not going to always have plastic and you're not always going to have the machines. The broom corn's something you can grow and make it yourself. You don't have to go and buy it.
Wanda Hott's brooms have been getting noticed. She's even had customers as far away as California and Illinois. And with her entire family also interested in making brooms, for now, it looks like this art form won't be disappearing in West Virginia anytime soon. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Kirby, West Virginia.
Ever since Jim Schaefer sold his broom-making equipment to Wanda, he wanted to go up and visit her workshop. And when we heard that trip was going to be too much for him, we invited Jim to a special live event closer to home. We screened a video version of his story, as well as Wanda's, at the Raleigh Playhouse and Theater in Beckley, and afterward invited Jim to talk on stage. Jim Schaefer. So, Jim, what'd you think about seeing that up on the big screen like that?
Well, it kind of gives you an odd feeling, you know, to see yourself up there, which you never expected to happen.
Yeah.
I still to this day don't understand how West Virginia Broadcasting has did what they've did for me, you know, as far as publicizing me and everything. So it's been quite a run.
In the video, you said you didn't expect broom making to be around much longer.
No, you go into Kroger's now. You are Kroger's or any of your supermarket type grocery stores. You're lucky if you find a broom in the rack. Mm-hmm. They, as far as straw brooms concerned, mm-hmm. Some of them carry them, some of them don't. But the plastics, the different aspects of life, of the different types of sweeping they do, and the different machines they have to do the sweeping and blowing instead of using a broom, has just brought it down to a little bit of nothing.
Mm. And you mentioned that it would be tough to make a whole lot of money making brooms nowadays.
Yes.
Was it always like that, though?
Well, it was always pretty much that way. It was always a minimum wage job, except for assembling the broom and sewing the broom. They were piecework. You got paid for each broom you threw it on the floor. If you stopped and took a smoke or anything, you didn't make a penny.
Oh.
Or anything else you stopped for. So it was strictly a piecework deal. Mm-hmm. And so I was in that area myself. I always done the sewing of the rooms. That's the way I started in. Mm-hmm. So I always fared pretty well as compared to the open market. Mm-hmm. But the broom shop as a group, doing the finishing of the brooms, getting the straw ready and everything for the broom makers and all, it was minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. So I take it you'd like to see broom making continue, though?
Well, it's not going to continue, I don't think,
okay.
Here in the United States.
So
But you did find, I think we heard in the video, that Wanda bought your equipment. She seems to be still making brooms.
Yes, she's still making brooms, and she's not making brooms for the commercial market. If you're making brooms for the commercial market, the price is so low, you have to compete with Mexico. She's making a homemade broom, and she's charging a fair price for it instead of competing with Mexico's prices. You just can't do it.
So what made you decide to sell your equipment?
Health. I just got to where I'd go down there every morning to the shop and go in, and I'd make half a dozen brooms. We'd work a half hour or maybe a little longer, and I'd get so tired I had to sit down. Hmm. And it's just progressively gotten worse. And Wanda offered to buy my equipment, and I said, well, I think it's time for old dad to leave.
Well, and this probably gives you some more time with your wife, right?
Gives me more time, but I ain't able to do anything.
Oh.
Sit there in the chair all day and feel like a crazy. You can't get up and get out and do anything. You have 5 minutes out there and you're just ready to sit down. You have to sit down.
Mm. Well, we're glad you're here, and we could get you a chair so we could chat.
Anywhere I go, I need that.
In the video, you say you've tried to get several people interested in making brooms and teaching them, but it hasn't stuck with most of them. Apart from Wanda Hott, are there others in West Virginia who you could see making brooms in the future?
No.
Nope.
No. I've taught quite a few how to make brooms and different things along, along that line, but none of them never stayed.
Well, what is it? Are they just that stubborn? I mean...
Well, it's you have to work constantly. You don't have to work hard, but you have to work all day.
You have to work.
As I say,
so that's
yeah.
the problem? They don't want to work, you think?
They don't want to work. Yeah. Not using their hands. They want to use computers. Mm.
That was broom maker Jim Schaefer during a listening party last October at the Raleigh Playhouse and Theater in Beckley, West Virginia. On our website, you can watch more of our conversation with Jim Schaefer and with the gristmill man Larry Mustaine, who we heard from at the beginning of the show. You can also watch the videos about today's guests and all the items they make at wvpublic.org. One of my favorite moments from that listening party we hosted in Beckley was when an audience member stood up to ask Larry Mustaine a question. He's a friend of mine who works at a state park where there's an old gristmill that's in need of some TLC. My friend offered to help Larry Mustaine restore the water wheel on his mill if Larry would share his knowledge about the old gristmill at the park. It's moments like those where people exchange knowledge and a helping hand that have continued to keep Appalachians going for generations. So let's find more ways to share these creative arts with each other. The artists we heard from in today's show didn't go to college to learn their craft. Some learned through a formal apprenticeship program, while others learned from their neighbors, their uncles, and their grandmas. I can just imagine some elderly people out there sitting at home just waiting to teach someone how to can green beans or repair a car or sew a quilt. All you have to do is ask. The worst they could do is say no. And best case, you'll learn to make something or grow something that'll keep you fed or keep you warm in the winter or at least keep your front porch as spick and span as Jim Schaefer's. And you'll probably make someone's day just by keeping them company while you learn. Do you know someone in your community or family who still makes things with their hands? What traditions are still out there? We'd love to tell more of these stories and help telling the stories before the knowledge is lost. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the West Virginia Folklife Program, a project of the West Virginia Humanities Council, with thanks to the Tamarack Foundation. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Robert Johnson, Spencer Elliott, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Catherine Moore edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories at wvpublic.org. And you can find Inside Appalachia on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.